It was at Andrews, Fran said. Dumped there on the 5th. When Marshall was recalled to Germany, I said. Franz nodded at the wheel. That's what their gate log says. Parked by Marshall with a Transportation Corps reference on docket. Our guys trailered it to the FBI, faster that way. They had to call in a few favors. The Bureau worked on it all night, reluctantly at first, but then they got interested in a big hurry. It seems to be tied in with a case they're working. Brubaker, I said. He nodded again. The trunk mat had parts of Brubaker on it. Blood and brain matter, to be specific. It had been scrubbed with a paper towel, but not well enough. Anything else, I said? Well, lots of things. There was blood from a different source, just trace evidence of a transfer smear, maybe from a jacket sleeve or a knife blade. Carbones, I said. From when Marshall was riding in the trunk afterwards. Did they find a knife? No, Fran said, but Marshall's prints are all over the inside of the trunk. They would be, I said. He spent several hours in there. There was a single dog tag under the mat, Fran said. Like the chain had been broken and one of them had slipped off and gotten away. Carbones, I said. None other. Amateur hour, I said. Anything else? Well, mostly normal stuff. It was an untidy car. Lots of hair and fiber, fast food wrappers, soda cans, stuff like that. Any yogurt pots? One, Fran said. In the trunk. Strawberry or raspberry? Strawberry. Marshall's prints on the foil tab. Seems like he had a snack. He opened it, I said, but he didn't eat it. There was an empty envelope, Fran said. Addressed to Kramer at 12 Corps in Germany. Airmail, postmarked a year ago. No return address. Like a photo mailer, but it didn't have anything in it. I said nothing. He was looking at me in the mirror. Is any of this good news? He said. I smiled. It just moved us up from speculative to circumstantial. A giant leap for mankind, he said. Then I stopped smiling and looked away. I started thinking about Carbone and Brubaker and Mrs. Kramer and Mrs. Reacher. All over the world, people were dying in the early part of January 1990. In the end, it took us more than an hour to get to Irwin. I guess it was true what people said about L.A. highways. The post looked the same as it usually did, as busy as always. It occupied a huge acreage of the Mojave Desert. One or other of the armored cavalry regiments lived there on a rotating basis and acted as the home team when other units came in to exercise. There was a real spring training atmosphere. The weather was always good. People always had fun in the sunshine, playing with the big expensive toys. "You want to take care of business right away?" Franz asked. "Are you keeping an eye on them?" He nodded. "Discreetly." So let's have breakfast first. A U.S. Army O Club was the perfect destination for people half-starved on airline food. The buffet was a mile long. Same menu as in Germany, but the orange juice and the fruit platters looked more authentic in California. I ate as much as an average rifle company, and Summer ate more. Franz had already eaten. I fueled up on as much coffee as I could take. Then I pushed back from the table. Took a deep breath. "Okay," I said. "Let's go do it." We went back to Franz's office, and he made a call to his guys. They told him Marshall was already out on the range, but Vassal and Coomer were sitting tight in a VOQ rec room. Franz drove us there in his Humvee. We got out on the sidewalk. The sun was bright. The air was warm and dusty. I could smell all the prickly little desert plants that were growing as far as the eye could see. Irwin's VOQ looked like it had been built by the same motel contractor that had gotten the 12 Corps contract in Germany. There were rows of identical rooms around a sandy courtyard. On one side was a shared facility. TV rooms, table tennis, lounges. Franz let us in through a door and stepped to one side, and we found Vassal and Coomer sitting knee-to-knee in a pair of leather armchairs. I realized I'd seen them only once before, when they came to my office at Byrd. That seemed disproportionate, considering how much time I'd spent thinking about them. They were both wearing crisp new BDUs and the revised desert camouflage, the pattern people were calling chocolate chip. They both looked just as fake as they had in their woodland greens. They still looked like Rotary Club members. Vassal was still bald, and Coomer was still wearing eyeglasses. They both looked up at me. I took a breath. Senior officers. Harassment.
It could be you that goes to jail.
General Vassal, I said, and Colonel Coomer, you are under arrest on a charge of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice in that you conspired together and with other persons to commit homicide. I held my breath. But neither one of them had a reaction. Neither one of them spoke. They just gave it up. They just looked resigned, like the other shoe had finally dropped and the inevitable had finally happened. Like they'd been expecting this moment from the start. Like they'd known for sure it was coming all along. I breathed out. There were supposed to be all kinds of stages in a person's reaction to bad news. Grief, anger, denial. But these guys were already through all of that. That was clear. They were right there at the end of the process, butted hard up against acceptance. I cued Summer to complete the formalities. There were all kinds of things from the Uniform Code that you had to spell out. All kinds of advisements and warnings. Summer ran through them better than I would have. Her voice was clear, and her manner was professional. Neither Vassal nor Coomer responded at all. No bluster, no pleading, no angry protestations of innocence. They just nodded obediently in all the right places. Got up out of their chairs at the end without even being told.
Handcuffs?
Summer asked me. I nodded. For sure, I said. And walk 'em to the brig. All the way. Don't put 'em in the truck. Let everybody see 'em. They're a disgrace. I got directions from a cavalry guy and took Franz's Humvee to go get Marshall. He was supposed to be camped out in a hut near a disused range target, observing. The disused target was described to me as an obsolete Sheridan tank. It was supposed to be fairly beat up. The hut was supposed to be in better shape and close to the old tank. I was told to stick to the established tracks to avoid unexploded ordnance and desert tortoises. If I ran over the ordnance, I'd be killed. If I ran over the tortoises, I'd be reprimanded by the Department of the Interior. I left the main post alone, at 9:30 in the morning exactly. I didn't want to wait for Summer. She was all tied up with processing Vassal and Coomer. I felt like we were at the end of a long journey, and I just wanted to get it over. I took a borrowed sidearm, but it was still a bad decision. Irwin owned enough of the Mojave that it could be a plausible stand-in for the vast deserts of the Middle East, or, if you ignored the heat and the sand, a plausible stand-in for the endless steppes of Eastern Europe. Which meant I was long out of sight of the main post buildings before I was even a tenth of the way to the promised Sheridan tank. The terrain was completely empty all around me. The Humvee felt tiny out there. It was January, so there was no heat shimmer, but the temperature was still pretty high. I applied what the unofficial Humvee manual called 240 air conditioning, which meant you opened two windows and drove at 40 miles an hour. That set up a decent breeze. Normally, 40 miles an hour in a Humvee feels pretty fast because of its bulk. But out there in the vastness, it felt like no speed at all. A whole hour later, I was still doing 40 and I still hadn't found the hut. The range went on forever. It was one of the world's great military reservations. That was for sure. Maybe the Soviets had a bigger place somewhere, but I would have been surprised. Maybe Willard could have told me. I smiled to myself and kept on going. Drove over a ridge and saw an empty plain below me. A dot on the next horizon that might have been the hut. A dust cloud maybe 5 miles to the west that might have been tanks on the move. I kept to the track. Kept going at 40. Dust was trailing behind me like a tail. The air coming in the windows was hot. The plane was maybe 3 miles across. The dot on the horizon became a speck, and then grew larger the closer I got to it. After a mile, I could make out two separate shapes. The old tank on the left, and the observation hut on the right. After another mile, I could make out three separate shapes. The old tank on the left, the observation hut on the right, and Marshall's own Humvee in the middle. It was parked to the west of the building in the morning shade. It looked like the same shoot-and-scoot adaptation I'd seen at 12 Corps in Germany. The building was a simple raw cinder block square. Big holes for windows, no glass. The tank was an old M551, which was a lightweight armored aluminum piece that had started its design life as a reconnaissance vehicle. It was about a quarter of the weight of an Abrams, and it was exactly the type of thing that people like Lieutenant Colonel Simon were betting the future on. It had seen service with some of our airborne divisions. It wasn't a bad machine. But this example looked pretty much decomposed. It had old plywood skirts on it, designed to make it resemble some kind of previous generation Soviet armor. There'd been no point in training our guys to shoot at something our other guys were still using. I stayed on the track and coasted to a stop about 30 yards south of the hut. Opened the door and slid out into the heat. I guessed it was less than 70 degrees, but after North Carolina and Frankfurt and Paris, it felt like Saudi Arabia. I saw Marshall watching me from a hole in the cinder block. I'd only seen him once, and never face to face. He'd been in the Grand Marquis on New Year's Day, outside Byrd's post headquarters, in the dark, behind green-tinted glass. I'd pegged him then as a tall, dark guy, and his file had confirmed it. He looked just the same now. Tall, heavy, olive skin, thick black hair cut short. He was in desert camouflage, and he was stooping a little to see out the cinder block hole. I stood next to my Humvee. He watched me, silently. "Marshal," I called. He didn't respond. "You alone in there?" No reply. "Military police," I called louder. "All personnel, exit that structure immediately." Nobody responded. Nobody came out. I could still see Marshall through the hole. He could still see me. I guessed he was alone. If he'd had a partner in there, the partner would have come out. Nobody else had a reason to be afraid of me. "Marshall," I called again. He ducked out of sight, just melted backward into the shadows inside. I took the borrowed gun out of my pocket. It was a new issue Beretta M9. I heard an old training mantra in my head. Never trust a weapon that you haven't personally test-fired. I chambered around. The sound was loud in the desert stillness. I saw the dust cloud in the west. It was maybe a little larger and a little closer than before. I clicked the Beretta's safety to fire. "Marshall," I called. He didn't reply, but I heard a low voice very faintly, and then a brief scratchy burst of radio static. There was no antenna on the roof of the hut. He must have had a portable field radio in there with him. "Who are you going to call, Marshall?" I said to myself. "The cavalry?" Then I thought, the cavalry. An armored cavalry regiment. I turned and looked west at the dust cloud. Suddenly realized how things stood. I was all alone in the middle of nowhere with a proven killer. He was in a hut. I was out in the open. My partner was a 90-pound woman about 50 miles away. His buddies were riding around in 70-ton tanks, just below the visible horizon.